Hello there! You're listening to the Goblin Broadcast Network. GBNcom.com. Did you mean to do that?
Welcome to the Gamers Haven Podcast, a gaming podcast for game masters of all gaming systems. So grab your dice bags and we'll get your game on. Welcome back to the Gamers Haven Podcast. We're now getting into the newest episode, and we're going to be talking about creation myths and basically getting this whole thing started, I guess.
This
time it's personal.
Of course it's personal. It's our smurfing world.
That's true. You and the whole smurfing thing, man.
Well, what can I say? I have a bad smurfing mouth.
Yeah, you do. Really? You know.
Did we ever capture any smurfs?
We're working on it.
Got a couple of mice and a rat. The rat's kind of weird. It keeps eating this weird stone and it keeps getting bigger.
Should we feed him to Mansquito?
We need to feed it to Mansquito and get rid of him. No, we're not feeding him Mansquito. Warpstone is not a good thing. I don't want, like, a 30-foot-tall Mansquito rampaging around.
That'd be awesome.
No.
Did you already feed the rat to Mansquito? Okay. I'm just going to send Mansquito up the chute and see what happens.
What city are we under today?
I don't know.
That whole plate tectonics and crap moving around.
Mm-hmm.
That or the planner traveling device.
Yeah. How's that come along anyway?
Well, we haven't gotten any feedback on it, so I just built it myself, and I've already hooked it up to the whole facility.
Oh, you hooked it up to the whole facility?
Yeah.
Is that where we get those strange power burns where the lights dim?
Yeah.
Ah, jeez.
I've actually had to, even though it's a magical thing, I had to have some sort of scientific energy, so I've hooked it. I had to use the time machine. I've hooked up the power source from the future. It's kind of neat how it happens.
I don't even know how that even works.
It's not enough power.
But yes, we're going to continue talking today about world creation and the whole getting it started. So I think we're just going to move on to messages from our wonderful podcast people, and we'll be back.
Podcast associates.
Go switch off!
Aw, welcome, welcome. Come on in. Please, please. Have a seat, warm yourself by the fire, and listen to the friendly minstrel's song. What? You've come seeking the tome? Well, you are in luck. I am the keeper of the tome. And what would you do with this mighty podcast? Oh, good, good. You have the right idea. You see, the tome is a source for expanding your understanding of Dungeons and Dragons and what various books have to offer. The tome's knowledge is endless when it comes to Dungeons and Dragons. So sit, listen, and become a sage of great renown. The Tome is a Dungeons & Dragons review podcast focused on official content. You can find The Tome at http://thetome.podbean.com or search for The Tome on iTunes.
You've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
Yes, we are back, and one of us is in a festive mood, apparently. But like we said in the intro, we're talking about creation and sort of in the beginning creation myths. Jeremy, you wanted to kick this one off, so why don't you?
Well, we've got two things to talk about. One, the creation myths themselves of our world, as well as how to get started in actually developing the world.
Right, right. And then the actual, sort of like, What I think we're trying to go for here is the springboard for us to create the world, and then the spring then within that world
created,
how it was created
within the world. Which one do we want to start with?
Let's start with the creationalism, the creational myths.
Okay. Well, for Thera, in the beginning there was void, and within the void there was a single thought. That single thought continued growing until it became the creator. The creator slept in this nothingness for, well, there's no time, so he slept forever. But he woke up. While he had been sleeping, though, both his dreams and nightmares created those beings that exist outside of our reality. The dreams weren't always good, but they were definitely not like the nightmares. But when the creator woke up, he realized he was alone. All of his dreams and nightmares had fled and gone into the great void. And so he was alone. So he created for himself playmates, still being a young intellect. And he created various spirits that could not serve him as slaves, but be friends with him, do various things. He frolicked or whatever in the void with these spirits for, again, another eternity. And then he grew tired of it, and he went back to sleep. When he awoke, he found that things were much different. The primal, I don't want to say fluids, but the building blocks of everything we know had been created. Yeah, had been created by these serving spirits. And he saw this, and he thought it was good. And he decided to help them along. And he brought some sort of order to the chaos. And as time went on, he grew, his mind grew more, not from a child, but more into an adult. And he brought order to the chaos and helped build the different universes and planes of existence. And one of those universes that he created was the universe that my world, Thera, would be exist in. And he put one of his helper spirits in charge of this world, or this universe. And this spirit then, therefore, helped the universe start. And in the beginning of Thera, the first that came along was the sun. And the sun also grew lonely and brought to himself other beings about him. And one of those beings was Thera. Thera is not a goddess. She is a planet, but she's also an entity. And soon Thera and the sun, Solaris, as he became known by the Atlanteans later on, they came together, and they also created all of the first races on Thera. And that would be the beginning of my world.
Wow. Yours is completely different from mine.
Well, and that's just one story, but...
Well, none of the races in the world remember the age of gods. But I do have it written out, and I didn't bring it with me, which makes me feel stupid, because there's little things that I forget when I don't have the paper in front of me. But to give you a basic idea, here's the run out. And the time before my planet was populated, the planet existed. It was a barren rock, circling lifelessly around a sun in the solar system. The gods did not exist. The gods were actually not even in the same solar system. What happened was, in fear of persecution and fleeing their own destruction, several different entities, which became the gods, fled from their native environment and fled into space to save themselves. In the process, many were lost along the way until they finally came to this barren rock, which bared a semblance to the planet that they left from. Upon reaching the galaxy, they realized that they were quite different than when they had left, being able to do things that they had never been able to do before. But upon reaching this planet and settling down and generating, for lack of a better term, basic life like plants and animals, they began to realize that they were fading from existence. they had nothing there to substantiate them, to keep them there anymore. And as time progressed, they faded from existence and ceased to exist. At this point, they decided to create something that would believe in them, something with a semblance of intelligence. And with the first race that was created was orcs. Orcs, however, not being cast in the same image, just being cast from an amalgam of thoughts and ideas, there was conflicts with the race, making them short-lived, unintelligent, and incredibly ferocious. At this point, the gods, what had then had been established as gods, split. There was a schism? Is that how it's pronounced? And the way that they dealt with each other. And factions were created. Each faction decided they were going to create their own race to worship them solely, which then thus propagated the older races, including the elves and the dwarves. From these two groups, a basic established religion was formed and proceeded for quite a few centuries. As time progressed, additional fleeing entities came across this galaxy and chose to cohabit either this planet or other planets in the universe, actually creating populations of various different species on different planets in the solar system. And it was at this point, near the end of the Age of Gods, that humans were actually created, humans being the youngest race other than halflings, which is interesting because I always thought of halflings as a different type of human. I'm just throwing that out there. Gnomes were actually not created in the Age of Gods, so just to give you an idea. So gnomes did not exist by this point, and neither did a couple of the other races that are actually playable in my world, because they actually weren't created by gods. And we'll talk about them here in a little bit. Once the gods had established worshipping races, they sat back and let their races have free will on the planet. At this point in time, we move into the Age of Enlightenment. In the Age of Enlightenment, dragons existed on the planet. They were actually created by a god by the name of Salpraxis, who has ceased to exist due to the fact that all the dragons fled from the planet, actually at the end of the Age of Mythology, which is the preceding age, or the following age, I'm sorry. Following age from the Age of Enlightenment. It was at this point that the dragons actually created the race known as the River Folk. They created them as shortly before they fled as a reminder to all species or races on the planet that dragons did exist. However, this faded with time, as with many other things, and was forgotten to the point where people or races didn't believe in dragons. They thought they were a myth, a creation, of nightmares to, keep kids being good. Don't do this or the dragons will come and eat you. However, we now know that's to be different. Following the Age of Enlightenment is the Age of Myth. And the Age of Myth, coming from the Earth, actually created by accident by the dwarves and their god, came the gnomes and the halflings. The halflings actually are actually, in my world, are a misshapen form of humans. It was an amalgamation of humans and dwarves, and a terrible accident that generated and created the halflings. But the race was peaceful, and was decided that it would be allowed to live. And that's how basically all the races got started on my planet. It was at the end of myths that the world settled down and became a place of different factions and nations.
I've got a continuation real quick, because mine didn't get quite that far.
Oh.
No, I wanted to break it up, though.
Oh, okay.
I think that's great.
And well, mine's really small.
You want to do yours, though?
My world actually doesn't have a creation myth associated with it. What I plan on doing when we get back to my world is actually enlisting the aids of my friends, actually, and telling you to pick a race and make a creation myth based on that race. Because I look at a world building, and I look at, like, especially in a fantasy campaign or anything, more culturally based, because on Earth, we have their creation myths for the Greeks, the Romans, the Norse, the Chinese, the Japanese, and they're all different. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows what's really going to happen, what's real, what's anything like that. And that's what I want to try to emulate with my world. Now, I have touched on in the past with my fantasy setting called Spiriton, that the world sits, the world is a ball that surrounds a thing called the spell pool, and the spell pool is fed by the river of time, and up at the start of the river of time is the citadel, the grand citadel, or something like that, where the dragon gods sit and pass judgment over reality and rule over the dragons. But there was and the human or the mortal gods were created by the dragon gods, and then there was a god war and they split. And it was decided that the dragon gods would basically only deal with the dragons, and the mortal gods would deal with the mortals. And that's about as far as it's gotten, but not many people know about that.
Well, just to get up to the creation of the gods of mine, because I stopped at with Thera.
Mm-hmm.
After Thera herself.
So you went sort of with Thera is more like the planet Gaia in Greek mythology.
Yeah. After Thera created, one intelligent race kind of developed on its own. And Thera decided her work was done and locked herself away. And she also locked away some of the spirits that were her children, because she wanted, at first, she thought that the world could go on without them. And the intelligent race, they look human, they aren't human, though. The first race was very primitive, developed fire, things like that, continued forward. When at some point, and again, there was no history, these people didn't have a written history, at some point, a space-going race called the Cathari Ogrim,
I didn't know they were a space-faring race.
Appeared from another universe and was conquering planets like crazy, and conquered the world of Thera. And for, who knows, thousands of years, tens of thousands of years, they used the people of Thera, and there's only one race. Whatever these people are, nobody knows. But they used them as their playthings, and their servants, and their slaves. And it was not until enough of the people called out for various things. At one instance, there was a great burial of these people. They were just murdered. They were all murdered by the Cathari Ogrim and buried in this great pit. And their souls called out for release because there was no afterlife. There was nothing. They just were there. And the spirit appeared, who at that point named himself Crodel. In another place, there was a facility that was experimenting on these people. And they were calling out in their pain for healing. And the spirit of healing, who called herself Rashira, appeared and took away their disease and their alterations and put it on their captives.
Sorry.
In another area,
I mean, put it on their captors.
Captors, excuse me.
Yeah.
I'm ill still, I'm sorry. Put it on the Cathari Ogrim. Basically healed the people and turned on the jailers. Another individual, his daughter had been raped by a Cathari Ogrim captain. And when the father went and demanded vengeance, and actually physically assaulted the officer, well, you cannot do that. So both him and the daughter were going to be executed. So he called out for justice. And the spirit appeared, called Trajan, and gave them justice by slaying everyone there who was, you know, all the Cathari Ogrim. And the last one was this soul, this individual who's been tortured. This individual, he was actually murdering Cathari Ogrim citizens. You know, he was captured, he was being tortured. And he called out, and the spirit of darkness, who named herself Shagira, appeared and promptly tortured everyone around her, including the gentleman who called her. Then made that gentleman her slave. And all these entities were being called to one area. And as they were being called, they gathered the forces of the people with them, and they came to Thera's tomb. And at Thera's tomb, that's when they started doing rituals to open up Thera's tomb, let out the other spirits. There were still no gods. There was still ordering that needed to be done. So Crodel, the god of death, he started ordering things. Rashira, the goddess of healing, she started ordering things and so on. And
but currently they were spirits.
Currently they were spirits. They were nasty things. I mean, they could physically affect the world. And when they fought, I mean, basically they were trying to let the people get some freedom. And they released both the god of magic and the god of psionics, who taught the people. They each taught the people something different. And at that point, they then took the war back to the Kalari Ogrim, and with the help of the spirits, who were the leaders, they basically killed the leaders of the Kalari Ogrim, and at the same time, they did a ritual that unleashed all the magic in the world, which spread out along the world, spread out all along the galaxy, and the Kalari Ogrim spacecraft could not function. They were just like their life support systems would stop working.
Cathari or Kalari?
It's Kalari Ogrim. The magic actually destroyed their ships, and the ones on the planet were cut off. So until the magic dissipated, which they thought it would, they were
trapped.
They were trapped with these very angry spirits and very angry slaves, and they offered them a choice. Either one, you leave. Once you're able to, you leave and never come back, or we're going to destroy you. And once the magical energy in the galaxy was absorbed by the planets, so the ships were able to come in, and the masters on that planet did leave. But that's why there's a myth among the gods, and these spirits would become gods as the people realized that, hey, they can do this. Some of these people that fought with the spirits, though, became servants of the gods. And that's where you get, like, the djinn and stuff like that. And then the gods were created from some of the people left behind. So that gets us up more to the gods.
Okay.
So that's, like, some creation myth stuff. Now how do we create our worlds in a real life?
Well, real quick, as far as coming up with a creation myth, what really inspires you to look into that? Do you go look at the Greek creation myths, biblical creationism?
Do you honestly
sort of
know
thing?
Where I got mine from? The beginning of mine. You know what came from? Civilization, the computer game.
Mm. There you go.
I know it's pathetic.
Well,
but
in mine...
And with me, I didn't even... I just made my world. I didn't even think about a creation story.
Oh, I didn't. And actually,
when you're creating your world, don't sit down and start at the beginning and try to figure it all out immediately.
I didn't finish.
Fill in the blanks, you know? It's like, leave it. Say, with mine, I don't really have an explanation as to why the world exists. All I know is that it does.
Yeah, mine hasn't even gotten to the point of why the races like the elves and the dwarves and things like that, because I kind of like what you're thinking about doing. They all have their own creation myth.
Yeah.
Certain races are going to be closer to what actually
they have a cultural
happened.
Identity.
What the actuality of creation on my planet is based on versus what the people believe happened are two totally different things.
Right.
I haven't gotten into that yet because no one remembers the age of enlightenment or the age of the gods except for the gods and the dragons.
And also,
and the dragons are just coming back now.
As time goes on, what people believe will become more important than what actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
Because for my game
alter reality.
And for my people, does this ancient race of creatures who fought an ancient war matter? Not really. Does it matter that they helped create the gods? Yeah, that matters. But those spirits were always there. But you're right. Do we create the worlds from the creation myths? No, I never did that.
No. God. I just finished
you
my
You start
creation.
The world, and then you develop this later
right.
on.
I finished my creation myth a year and a half ago, and I've been working on my world.
I'm still working on mine.
Yeah. Well,
it's all ongoing.
When you're creating your world, you know, I mean, it's a definitely a key point to look at and say, well, I more look at it from a cultural identity point of view. As I understand, it's like dwarves are going to look at the world differently than elves do. Elves are going to look at it differently than humans. Humans differently than orcs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And you don't have to have a right one.
Right, and, right. And if you're playing in different ages, that idea of creation, a creation can change from one age to another. One age, the orcs can say, oh, we all came out of a pot of stew. The next year, it's like, oh, no, we were forged from, you know...
Forged from the steel of the
steel or whatever, right? Also, something you have to think about, though, this is something I've thought of for my future of my world. Just because science says one thing, most of my people aren't going to... They're going to say, well, that's fine. Science says this. My culture and my views say this. They can coexist.
Right.
It's like intelligent design, which...
I know we're in Kansas.
Yeah, which means I really can't even talk about it legally.
Yeah.
Oh, screw that. Whatever. You can coexist between...
But it's the idea of,
I have to throw out the other one, the Great Spaghetti Monster.
Yes. Great Spaghetti Monster, we love them. But the idea of creating a world pops in your head. Just sit down and figure out what it's like now. You don't necessarily have to sit down and figure out what it was like then.
Yeah, the age itself, actually started when I started having people playing in the world.
A lot of this is just for us.
Yeah.
But it's not even for the players.
Yeah, the players never see this.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of times it's for us because we're either...
Because we like to have a place to that
you
where
like
we're coming
to have
from.
Depth.
Right. A history to it. And that's something I always struggle with is I want to share that history with the players but not be dry and boring about it.
And that's why you have to share it within the game at that point.
Right.
So, like, if a person's playing a cleric and they want to know, where did I come from... Or the difference between my creation myth and my god. My god might have a creation myth.
Yeah.
Does my god worship a god?
Exactly.
You know, that's important, but only in-game. And I like that GM's book. What is the name of that book?
That Aaron wrote? It's GMing Secrets 2nd Edition.
I liked what he said about world building in there. Where basically you start with a
small
little campaign.
He's insanely busy right now, and I can't get him for an interview, but I do.
You start with a town. With the little outlying place. And then you start with the forest, and so on and so on.
I'll say how my world basically started up for me was an indie D&D, picked up the third edition Player's Handbook at Gen Con, decided to run it, and I just picked up, I just printed out an introductory adventure off the website and used that and built from there as the players moved off. And I actually found myself needing to build a world once I decided they were leaving the continent, you know?
And
then I just built it from there.
Yeah.
And you can do that because, I mean, especially from the players and the characters' point of view, it's like, well, the only world you've known is this village.
Yeah.
You know there's another village around and there's, you know, mountains to the east or whatever. You know, but if you don't need to fill in what's beyond the mountains, don't until you absolutely need to.
Until it happens. Unless, you know, it adds depth. But, like, I notice in my game, it's like a lot of stuff is interesting to the players, but only at that time. They
right.
need to know, like...
And don't feel constrained by map, either.
No.
Because, I mean, map making at the times, in this sort of a setting, isn't going to be an exact science. It's going to be, hey, there's mountains over there. Don't know how long they are, how tall they are, or where they... Mm-hmm. What's in there, but there's mountains.
And you can. I love the Here Be Monsters area.
Yeah, exactly. It's really, it's like, well, there's not a town on the map here, but there's a town there. Mm-hmm. You know, that's definitely something you want to think about is don't feel constrained by what you're given. You know, even if you're running a game in a pre-made world like Forgotten Realms or whatever, change it, you know? If there's not a village on the map, put one there.
That's why I like handwritten
maps. Not all
maps
are necessarily there.
Yeah,
exactly.
I also like handwritten maps because every once in a while I'll be drawing a map and suddenly my ink pen or whatever, it makes a blob on the map. I'm like, oh, crap. Should I get rid of that? No, I'm just going to leave it on there.
Yeah.
I'm not going to label it, but it's going to remind me.
For some reason, I don't really like the computer program mapping programs because it's too clean for me.
I like that
fractal mapping program.
Oh, yeah.
By NMOS software.
Once you figure out how to work it, it's
yes,
fine.
It's great. Also, the nice thing about it is you can do layout maps for dungeons and stuff, too.
Yeah,
with that thing,
and those programs
great.
Work well for that. But
for dungeons stuff,
we're
getting
off subject. But that was my inspiration as far as making my world. Jeremy, you touched on yours briefly. I mean, you just sort of evolved out of the need for you and your brother to have something to do.
Yeah,
you know?
Need to have a, yeah.
Have a world to play in. And
mine
you know.
Was completely different from both of yours. As I was stating earlier before we started the show, was that originally, at the time I was working for a company where I spent a lot of time on the phone, and in between phone calls I had nothing to do. Mm-hmm. And I always carried my art book with me.
Was
I
working for Disney?
Yeah. And it started off, I was doodling, but I started off with a doodle on a piece of paper, and it looked kind of interesting, so I expanded on it, and expanded on it, and expanded on it. And eventually it just turned into a map of a continent, which is, I thought was kind of weird. So I just, you know, started embellishing on the continent. I added mountains, and then I added some rivers, and then I added some forests. And then I started adding cities. Just started adding cities, and you know, cities started popping up. I started coming up with names, started doing population amounts and stuff. And I had been playing D&D at this point for years, so I had a rough idea what I would use it for if I ever got around to it. But at that point in time, I was only playing in games. I wasn't running games very often. And when I did run games, it was for very small groups of people who, you know, were new people, so that they wouldn't go like, "You're weird, thanks, man. I don't like your game. You don't know how to GM." So, you know, it was all very basic stuff. And started off with just a couple little towns, and then I expanded on that, and expanded on that, and expanded on that, and expanded on that. And then suddenly I was doing things like creating gods and histories and different ages and stuff to run the people through, because it just grew. It was like, the best way to describe it was like all this information was already in my head, I just didn't know how to get it out.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not going to work for everybody. I mean,
no.
My route is what they classify as the artistic route. I started off with an actual visual representation and expanded on it with the information from there. Yours is based on what's called the, I've heard it called the logical creation system, which is you start off with what you're going to use and expand what you're going to use when you need to use it. And whereas Jeremy's is based on the need creation.
Insanity.
No, need creation. You needed something else that you could actually use to go to. And so since it was needed, you made it.
But also, and I don't say this to sound weird, but I think it's more like a writer thing.
Yeah,
I believe the story is already there. It just has to get through my craptastic filter of a mind and come out.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I like to look at it. So it doesn't always come out as clear as it should.
One thing that was pointed out to me as far as world building is if you're building a world, don't build a setting, build a world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're going to build a world that's like Greyhawk, okay, why don't you just use Greyhawk and modify it, you know? If you're world building, make it your own. Make something that is interesting to not only you, but other people, other players. Make it different from something that's out there, or else there's really no point
like in
having
world,
it.
The undead are actually are mutated, irradiated creatures.
Right. Things like that.
Died. And the fact that nobody really truly believes in them until they see them, and then it's a horrifying effect for them. Yeah, which is always great to see people roleplay when they see undead for the first time.
But these creation myths add depth.
Yeah, they add to the story.
To the story, to the race.
But they might not necessarily ever be seen by the player characters.
They might not.
No, that's true.
And for the most part, people haven't even seen my notes on the cities that I have on mm-hmm. my maps. All my cities that are labeled on my map, most of the players have no idea any of the information about them. I have it all mapped out. I know all the different ages, what the populations and the various densities are through all the ages. But my players will probably never see them.
But they don't need to.
They don't need to.
That's
information
the point.
For me.
Well, we're running short on time for the discussion, so we're wrap it up, and then we'll continue our world building series in the next
Part
episode.
Part 3.
So we'll be back after these important messages.
With a three-parter.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
It's the PAX. The G23 Paxilin Hydrochloride.
You went out on a broad wave, sir. Everyone who wants it has it.
You need to control this damage. Start a discrediting campaign to deal with these.
Sir, we feel you should know. There are other projects.
Get ready.
I would like to introduce myself. I am Gerald, your hostage.
To live at the edge.
What do you mean he's dead?
Just because I ain't a nice person, sugar, doesn't mean we can't deal.
This attack wasn't random. Selected.
Surviving in the verse has never been harder.
You'll make a fine Alliance officer someday.
For a brown coat like you. After Serenity, the ongoing campaign, the story has a new season.
What do you mean he's dead?
Hey, what do you guys mean? Is he dead?
Is he dead?
He's dead, isn't he? What do you mean by that?
AfterSerenity.com.
Did you see the memo about this?
Well, we're back with our wonderful three-parter section. Today, I'm going to be giving you guys an NPC. Jeremy's got a little rant or a rave to give us, and Nathan's going to give us a nice review. So we're going to go ahead and start off with the We've Got Character.
We've Got Character.
Well, today on We've Got Character, I've got a character I'm going to give you guys, an NPC from my last D&D game I ran. Now, this guy's a vampire. His name is Mason. He lives on his own demiplane. Has a vampiric Pomeranian, and has a connection with another guy I'll eventually give you named Dyson, who gives him very odd magical creatures that Mason keeps in a dungeon. Now, the only reason he keeps them in a dungeon is so he can feed on them, because, you know, occasionally he likes to have different flavors of blood, whether it be from an outsider or a young, you know, young creature, or an older creature, centaur, elf, dwarf, etc. But, you know, he's a connoisseur of fine bloodlines. Well, Mason, lives on his own demiplane, and the people that show up, he either eats or enslaves. Well, the players were shot off or shunted off into his realm once, and when they woke up, they had been sold into his service as his maid, butler, chauffeur, etc.
Gardener. Freaking gardener.
Yes, with the plants that tried to eat you.
Yes, bastard. KY.
Yeah, KY. Mason will... Mason is a very prim and proper, I sort of based him off of a character from a game called Chronocross. I believe it was a character in there named Pierre, who walked around in pantaloons and a very poofy hat. I just pictured that guy walking around with a Pomeranian dog, sort of out of Legally Blonde. The
Pomeranian vampire dog from Blade 3.
Hey, they did this before Blade 3.
They stole that idea from you, man.
He runs around, and of course he feeds on things, and then the dog feeds on things as well.
That dog is pain.
Yes, yes. But I designed his whole castle, keeping in mind that he is a vampire. So there were segments of his castle that are completely off limits to corporeal beings, because as a vampire he can become mist and flow through small cracks, etc., which is how he would get to his coffin and various things. It was about a mile away from his castle, just in case, you know. Had vents all around so he could get in and out, and of course people got out of his place, they just would end up walking along the horizon and coming upon his place over the next hill, because it was his demiplane. Mason was eventually put into torpor by the characters when they ventured into his deep dark cellar, into the crypts beneath his castle, and found that he had walled up his wife in her sarcophagus, and they let her loose, and she went up and basically, that was not a pretty sight. Needless to say, Mason is now held deep within that sarcophagus, walled up and with enough mortar between him and the world to
never get out.
Yes. But the wife was kind enough to let all the players leave the wonderful domain, and I believe the dog was still alive.
Yes.
When you left.
Damn that dog. It has to die. Yeah.
I don't remember if I was the butler or what.
It was the freaking gardener that almost got eaten.
You were the butler, he was the gardener. Berg was the caretaker. But yes, you kept getting... One of the plants in the greenhouse was an amnesia plant. And you kept getting stung by it and forgetting the last 24 hours.
Yeah.
So you couldn't remember anything. It was funny.
Plant.
What was James's character?
He was the cook, I think.
He might have been the cook.
We don't even know why he had a cook. I mean, he was a freaking vampire. I think it was to cook food for us, which of course
we
wanted to eat anyways.
And you think about it, you know, when you guys were still, when you were sitting there eating the stew, which Mason wasn't eating. Mason was sipping away at some blood. You guys were eating the previous staff.
Yeah,
I know.
We kind of figured that out.
Yeah, not immediately though.
No. But you have to eat.
Because Mason was a sick bastard.
Yep. But he was fun.
Now he's dead.
Yes.
Or as close to death.
He's as close to death as we can get him without, you know, shoving a stake through his heart, cutting his head off, and burning it.
Yeah, but, you know, I think he's in a state worse than death now, so.
Yeah. But his wife occasionally pops in through her form and goes,
that was Mason, the pen and proper French vampiric, you know, fop, basically.
The rant.
Handouts. Now, GMs put a lot of work in their worlds and their games. Some of us have been able to make an art of it so we can prepare things a few hours in advance. But even in that case, we usually have something that we prepped a few weeks before. And when a GM is nice enough to put all your character sheets and handouts and house rules all into one neat little easily read packet, you should read them. You could sit there and have your bullshitting session. That's fine. We all need that before a game. But most of us can chew gum and walk at the same time, so therefore you can sit around and bowl
Smurf
and read at the same freaking time.
I can't.
Yeah, if the GM is nice enough to put down the house rules, if he's nice enough to organize things for you, help you out.
Or you could even read it before the
Smurf
session. Or you could even read it beforehand. If he's nice enough to let you take your character home, it will take 5 minutes. We're not talking about novels here. No. We're just
if it's
talking
a novel, then you've got a problem.
Then you got a problem. We're not talking about that. We're
talking 2-3 pages.
We're just talking a couple pages. Usually, I use big font. I like to spread it out. If I can, I can throw in some pictures.
You always throw in pictures. What are you talking about? If you can.
Read the handouts. So that way, in the middle of the game, when you ask a simple question, do you have rope?
Look at the freaking handout!
I don't know if I have rope. Do you have rope? I checked your character sheet, and I went through and made sure you had all the proper gear for you. What does your character sheet say? I don't know. Hey, it says I have rope. Oh, I guess you have rope. Or when you ask for a house rule that we've talked about multiple times and put it on a nice little sheet for you, and somebody goes, so what's this rule?
Smack him.
If you take out the sheet that says house rules, oh wait, there it is. So please, we put a lot of work into this. We're not asking much. We're just asking 5 minutes of your time. Also, it'll keep the other players happy. Some of those players who actually read everything.
We get sick and tired of listening to that one person asking the same stupid question over and over again.
We understand that we're human and we forget things, but be going through, that's part of the player's job is to go through the stuff that the GM gives them. If not, I'm going to keep the Cheetos and all the food for myself, and I'm going to throw things at you. Thanks, that's all.
Can't say they didn't deserve it when you threw the book at them.
That's true.
Of course, it was an expensive throw. Yeah. $40 a pop now.
A little bit of blood.
Sorry, just one of those tennis ball launchers.
Yeah. I was thinking of a dart gun.
That too. Then you just pick up a handful of gravel and throw it in.
Grab their face, rub it in the gravel.
Cayenne pepper in the face.
You don't have any players who are cutting...
Bear mace.
Like, going through anime books, cutting characters out of them. Hey, it's your turn. What do you want to do?
Or sitting there in the middle of the game and reading your, D&D book.
I don't know what I want to do. Well, I just spent the last 3 hours writing up all your attack to make it simple for ya! It's on the back of your sheet! The rest of us will already know what we want to do. I don't know. I need to read the character sheet! My brother's gonna kill ya! I'm just a player. Ethan's gonna kill ya. I'm gonna kill my brother. My brother's gonna kill ya.
I wasn't even there when I wanted to shoot the lady.
It's my turn. Okay, Ethan, I understand what we wrote right here. What does this mean? Okay, thank you. I'm gonna do this. How long did it take? It took 3 seconds. Oh! You, I'm going to hit with a car.
Doc!
The review.
We're back with the review. We're all losing our sanity, guys.
Which is great, because that's actually what I'm going to talk about today, is Call of Cthulhu. And we, as we all know, there are two different settings of the Call of Cthulhu. There is the actual, the classic setting, which is the Percentile Dice, which is actually written by Sandy Peterson and Lynn Williams, and the Willis, and the current version, with additional information by Keith Herber, William Hamblin, Mark Morrison, John Snyder, and Friends. And then there's also...
Did I actually say Friends on there?
And Friends.
Mm-hmm.
There's also the D20...
A lot more people have contributed to it in the new edition.
Yeah, the D20 version, which is actually based on the works of Lynn Willis and Sandy Peterson, which is actually written by John Tynes and Monty Cook.
Monty Cook!
I've seen lots of different variations on taking and adapting the percentile dice version of the D20 and an official version, unofficial versions, and previous failed attempts like the GURPS version. And I have to say that the version by Monty Cook is the most successful in capturing the D20 feel with the atmosphere of the Call of Cthulhu setting. Doesn't mean it's great, but it works. That being said, was I cut my teeth on this one, on the D20 version for GMing, and then I quickly moved on to the actual percentile dice version because there's so much more you can do.
Basic role-playing
version? Yeah, the BRP version. Because the BRP version is skills-based, whereas the D20 system is usually pretty much more along the lines of combat-based. The first thing you learn about Call of Cthulhu is combat. You don't want to get in it unless you absolutely have to. Why? Because you die. You're normal people. A gunshot wound can kill you. A single gunshot wound can kill a player. Why? Because people aren't built to withstand a .45 caliber slug ripping through their body and puncturing a hole the size of a golf ball at their back. That being said, the way the setting is set, it takes place, there's a modern-day setting, and then there's a 1920s setting, and then there's what's called Cthulhu by Gaslight, which is the Victorian setting, which takes place in the 1890s. All the games I've run have been in the 1920s. The 1920s setting is great if you actually research the setting before starting. You can get a rough idea of what the 1920s and the early 1930s were like, because, of course, if you're doing the 1920s, you got to do the 1930s as well, because, you know, that's when, you know, the horrible Great Depression is in effect, and people can look at that and say that that was actually affected, you know, by the elder gods exerting their will upon reality, that they caused, you know, humanity great suffering and pain. But enough of that. There's a general layout of the timeline for that time, incorporating all the stories that were actually written by H.P. Lovecraft to give you a rough idea of where everything takes place in the late 1910s and the mid to late 1920s. The setting is an absolute fear setting. The goal of the characters is basically pretty much they're investigators, they're trying to solve a mystery, but their tantamount goal is to survive. Surviving in this game is no simple feat. Like I said before, combat is nasty. Monsters do horrible things like suck your minds out of your heads, or do terrible things that they're so incredibly awe-inspiring horror that it literally blasts what little grasp of reality you have as you realize that something like that, theoretically, within the grasps of your idea of physics, should not exist. But they do, which means that your idea of reality is completely and utterly wrong. As we know with humans, with our such a fragile grasp of how what the state of reality is, when we're told that we're wrong about something so absolute as reality, we generally have a hard time dealing with that. The monsters are nasty. They're not designed to be thrown at people all the time. You throw monsters at everybody, you're going to be running through a lot of character sheets. That's another thing. Make sure that if you're going to run a game with considerable amount of monsters, make sure you have lots of character sheets on hand and streamline the process of making a character for the players. Because characters, whereas they don't take a long time to make, they still take a little bit of time, about 20, 30 minutes. And if you're running through a character every 2 hours, that's not going to be fun for the players either. I personally, I like the setting. I like the idea As Jeremy will tell you, and he's correct in the statement, the overall mythos or background for the story is absolutely hopeless. It basically states that the humans are fighting a losing battle, and in the end, the old ones will come back, which are the gods in the game that are these nasty monsters, including Cthulhu, who's actually an old one. Actually, he's an elder god, isn't he?
Cthulhu's an great old one.
Great old one?
He's a priest of the great old ones, so he's kind of a priest of the elder gods.
Yeah, he's nasty, whatever he is.
He's a big, nasty squid head.
Yeah, whose goal is to wake up and devour humanity. And it states in the mythos that eventually the old ones will come back, and the elder gods will return to the earth, and humanity will be destroyed because we're nothing but an insignificant speck in the layout of the universe. I like the game setting. I have fun running it. I'd like to think that the players that I have playing it have a fun time playing it. However, I run it a little bit more like Pulp Cthulhu, which is they're going to run into bad guys, but they're pretty much going to be cultists that are worshiping a said monster or some sort, because even like the little deep ones, which are supposed to be like the weak ones that actually can be killed fairly easy with just standard weapons, still can slaughter a team of players rather quickly.
It's a game of investigation, not of combat.
Yep. Your goal is to find out what's going on, not shoot everything in sight.
And then call the police?
Yeah, right.
yeah. You know, I'd call the police if there's some cultists that are killing people.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's a good idea.
I'm just not going to tell them about the Cthulhu part of it.
Yeah.
Or I'll say, they believe in this Cthulhu stuff. Obviously they're nuts, but yeah. Could you call them SWAT?
Yeah. So this takes place in the 1920s. I don't think there's a SWAT team.
Could you call in the guys with the building bombs?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyone but us.
This was the time before Miranda rides.
On a scale of 1 to 10, I would give this setting probably a 7.5. I like the game. It's not perfect. And like I said before, it's as Jeremy will tell you, it's a completely hopeless setting. There's no chance of actual winning. But if you can keep your characters alive for a long time, there is a minimum amount of achievement in that and fulfillment in that. I would give it a 7.5. I've definitely seen better settings, but I very much enjoy running it. As a GM, this is probably my favorite game setting to run. But overall, it's 7.5. What are your thoughts, Ethan?
I wouldn't really try running it myself. I don't think I could run it very well. I love the setting as just a plane as long as you've got a good GM. Thankfully, I do have a good GM to play under when it comes to Call of Cthulhu. It's a fun system as long as you have players that will work with you and that you will that it's understood that you're not there to, you know, horribly try to kill things and whatnot. You're trying to figure things out. I enjoy it, and campaigns can be done with it. It's just hard to do, in my opinion.
Yeah,
it's definitely a game you have to sort of adjust your method of running a game or playing in a game to be in. So,
we've only had one character die, but usually we've only done two basically sections of.
It's a highly atmospheric game.
Yeah, so do cool things like scary music in the background at low volumes and stuff. Oh, the size chart? Yeah, isn't it amazing how small people are compared to the great Cthulhu? But I like it. I have fun doing it. I have fun running it.
And Chaosium has a good sense of humor. That's what I like about him.
I have a love-hate relationship with it.
He loves to hate it.
I do love to hate it. But at the same time, what they've come up with for a mythology, I know they borrowed a lot.
It's all the mythos based in that book is all in the actual mythos of stories written by H.P. Lovecraft and August Derleth.
I like how in-depth that is.
It's because they've got thousands of stories
to go off of. Exactly. That's very neat. But, unfortunately, the way I've read the books for the game,
it is
I kind of read it in the wrong way, and so it's completely and utterly hopeless.
It is. For
so any character I'm going to make, if he has any inkling of what's going to happen, is going to take a gun and shoot himself in the head.
That's why the characters never know.
Now, have I played in one that I've enjoyed myself in?
No, because you've only played in two.
Exactly.
Yeah. And one of those was a failed one.
It's not a game system for everybody.
No, it's not.
This is something I do like, though. I like in the Dice 20 one, I like the Cthulhu mythology for the deities, because they work well for my Farrah.
Mm-hmm.
They are madness incarnate, and I like that part. I also do like, I mean, the book itself, like the books themselves are incredible.
Yeah,
I'll
give
you that.
Great. They're very well put together. And even the softback copies, which is the copy that Ethan has, I have the hardbound copies of pretty much all the books I could get the hardbound copies in, including the collector's edition of the Malleus Monstorum,
mm-hmm.
which I reviewed in an earlier edition, which everybody here, hands down, thought was an awesome book.
Yeah, the hardcover is much better looking than the softcover. I have the softcover. It's a great book. But
I won't buy the softcover.
Yeah.
I like...
It's a cool book, just to have.
It's cool, but I won't buy the softcover.
If I happen to find
the hardcover at some point again, I would pick it up.
Check next Halloween. Yeah. I bet you it was a limited run for when they announced it, but they might do limited runs. They were talking about doing limited runs like around Halloween.
Yeah.
Every year. So check with the Chaosium website, because it's going to be a Chaosium
only
item.
I will not diss anyone who enjoys Call of Cthulhu to play. I may even play in one.
Eventually, when we have the time that you can make it.
But my personal view is I don't like playing in the game. But I do enjoy, like, the book itself, like I said, is very neat.
Shop smart. Shop S-Mart. You got that?
In a broken world where magic has been outlawed.
The entire village knows your candles have a little somewhat special about them.
Like mother, like daughter.
Hang her.
She nearly burned the village down.
One family rules it all.
He did this. He killed my baby. He's a monster. No better than the fiend he calls a father.
One woman cursed with magic.
What have I done?
Becomes the pawn in a game of thrones that will tear the world apart.
Who is the woman you're so urgent to find?
Her mother.
Does she wear the red?
I'm not sure, my lord. It is said that she is breathborn. By all indications, though, she's unable to control it.
You will kill her.
Of course, my lord.
Do you think he knows?
When we find the woman, she will destroy him for us.
When her daughter is stolen...
Joss! They stole my Joss!
She wants only one thing, to get her back.
You were brave to have come here for me, my dear. You have no idea how foolish that bravery was, though. She was just a child. She was there to serve you.
What do you know of a mother's love? I will be killing you.
But that all changes when she finds her.
What have they done to you?
Join me. Together we can stop the Overlord. The children will go free.
Never!
Daughter of the Sun, the epic fantasy novel by Lana Eizel. Find out more about the novel, the author, and the podcast at LonnieEizel.com.
Invention, my dear friends, is 93% perspiration, 6% electricity, 4% evaporation, and 2% butterscotch ripple.
You can visit us on the web at CanadianCrusaders.FistfulOfComics.com. You can visit our website there, leave us an audio. You can call our voicemail line at 206-984-4122. Leave a message on the Frapper map. You can drop us an email at thousandmonkeysproductions@gmail.com. And you could also just visit the forums on Fistful of Comics. We have our own little section there.
This concludes the broadcast from World Control.
Expect no mercy if you head out of the west.
Gamers Haven is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Sharealike 2.5 license, and is hosted by the fine folks at www.fistfulofcomics.com and is a Thousand Monkeys production.
Now there's just one rule, and it's go eye for an eye. And if you swallow the drug,
I'd like to do a superhero game in Austin, Texas.
Draw the Texans up. Never mind.
Okay.
Well, you know, they'd have to, you know, they'd have to bring in, you know, superheroes from outside of Texas, because Texan superheroes would be like, I am the Alamo. Remember me.
Your name is the Alamo?
Shoot him in, from a cannon into the sun.
Whoa. Fire me, boy!
I'm okay.
There are 12.
Come on, Texan, Spleggs, work with me!
Texan superhero named the Alamo?
Yeah. And his call line is, I am the Alamo, remember me!
I think I would, if I was a villain, I would stop when he said that and just be like,
what?
Did you just say what I think he said?
Vaporize. Atomic brain just shows up, you're like, usually I don't come to Texas, but they called me.
Is there a real hero around here who can arrest me? Here, I'll call one.
Freedom League? Yes.
I'm robbing a bank right now. Could you come and arrest me?
Canadian Crusaders? Yes, please.
Anyone. Because this Alamo
yes, please,
guy... You, hey, why don't you say what you just said?
I am the Alamo! Remember me!
I'm yeah. not being arrested by him.
Uh-huh.
No.
Yeah, I'll wait.
Yeah.
12 hours later. Superheroes get out, beat the living daylights out of the Alamo.
Huh, I already put the handcuffs on me, so, you know.
Take me away!
Not in these jails, either. I'd rather be in a Canadian jail.
We're taking you to Canada.
Worse than a Mexican, or worse than a Russian gulag.
Because they'll hang me here.
Well, yeah.
Just,
like, Canada can't have anything else to do.
Canada will hit you with fish and make you drink beer and watch hockey.
Oh, okay.
The only person I've had to smurf on the podcast has been you.
If any human insect, guys come knocking on the door, I'm not here.
I've been feeding those to Mansquito anyway.
Oh, that's good, because they're the guys from the future I'm selling power from.
Really?
Yeah.
They're from the future?
Yeah.
What happened to humans?
They're only like 4 inches tall, dude.
After the apocalypse, you know, cockroaches survive.
I've been tossing them up in the air and Mansquito's been catching them. It's been pretty cool.
They're only a few inches tall when they come back?
Yeah, apparently.
Maybe I shrunk when I traveled then.
He was a fun one, and maybe next time I will. Some other time I will tell you about Dyson, his hello motto.
Yes.
I didn't know there were Smurfs in Fort Scott.
There were, but they're gone now.
Well, Smurfs are everywhere. They're sort of random little things.
Yeah.
That's cool. But infestation. You gotta get fumigated. It really sucks.
Oh yeah.
Be interesting.
In the superhero world.
I have to take my drugs now.
Drugs.
Wow. As they would say in some places, damn! I want to be a Canadian idiot. I want to be a hoozer and watch hockey. You like maple syrup, eh?
Yeah.
Oh, nice. I like maple syrup, too, eh? What do you think about fishing, eh?
I'm still ill while we record this. My apologies.
I was just curious.
Black Death!